Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. I'm Jerry, and we have a very exciting show for you tonight, and I'm joined by my fabulous co-hosts, Jamie and Chris. Guys, are you there?
Yeah. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfuckers.
Now, see, that's what I like to hear, an R-rated yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. Thank you very much for that. That's what we're talking about tonight. But before we go into John McClane, and thankfully that John McClane is back with us after all these years, Jamie has some important information about the shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Jamie?
Yeah, we got some exciting stuff coming up. Next Sunday, we're back to our regular time at 6 p.m. Eastern, and we've got an interview with a director named Perry Santos. He just directed a documentary on Rick James. It's called I'm Rick James. It doesn't have the bitch at the end. But we're very excited to talk to him about that. But also, he's got a really interesting career before he started on this documentary. He was Martin Scorsese's personal assistant on the set of Casino. He was an associate producer of Kundun, and he was James Cameron's assistant on Titanic. So this is an
Holy
exciting
crap.
Guest. Yeah, we've got a lot
what
to
a
talk
gig.
About.
That's quite a gig.
Yeah. So I'm sure he's going to be a fascinating interview. And then on the 22nd, we have our next two-hour tribute show, and this one is to Brian De Palma, who we're all crazy about. I don't think anyone more than Jerry, though.
You really have to rub that in, don't you? And if I told you I read David Thompson's biographical sketch in his biographical dictionary film, we're not going to talk about that because it's rather negative. But
Thompson's negative about everyone, isn't he?
Well, he's negative about everyone, but he's an interesting cat. He loves this stuff. He may love it more than we do. He does love Michael Corleone. His biographical sketch of Pacino is very loving, but it's mostly about Michael. But he does like one thing about De Palma, and that's Scarface.
Hmm.
He spoke very nicely of Scarface.
I don't think he's a true. He's obviously not a true De Palma fan.
But no, he'll be the first to tell you he's not a true De Palma fan.
Yeah, because I think that Scarface.
Only Scarface movie, you know. Come on, you got no love for Raising Cain, for Blow Up, or Blowout, you know?
Or any of them, no. It's very interesting, and before, and we'll because I want to save all the De Palma talk, Roy, for the 22nd, but just listening to it, when someone says Scarface is their favorite De Palma movie, it may be in many ways the least De Palma movie of all of them.
That's what I was going to say, yeah, because I think his kind of heightened sense of visual style that's in all of his movies is kind of muted in that movie, and it's replaced by the characterizations and the language.
That's very true. There are two people downstairs in my house who would agree with that assessment 100%. Okay, so let's hold off on De Palma for a couple weeks.
But I gotta say who our guest is. I have one confirmed guest.
Oh, okay. No, do it.
It is we have an actor that was in Carrie. He was a major part of Carrie, and he was also the greatest American hero. And I'm talking about William Catt. That is our first confirmed guest. And I think we're going to be looking at a lot of other people behind the scenes that worked with De Palma, and also some people that have spent a lot of time representing De Palma on the web, because if you search for De Palma on the web, you see a lot of impressive websites dedicated to his work. And as well as a biographer of his films as well. So I think we got another exciting show, and just look in the blogs for some more announcements as these confirmations come in.
Sounds good. It sounds like you've done another great job with this. Okay, so guys, this weekend it's really about a couple of things, but it's really about the return of one of the greatest action heroes of the second half of the 20th century, John McClane. Is it not?
It should be, yeah. Did you see the grosses today?
The grosses are pretty good. Come on, it's been 12 years since Die Hard with a Vengeance. You can't complain with that. You really can't.
What kind of numbers are we talking about?
Number two. But it's the highest gross of the films of all the films.
That's true.
You really can't complain about that.
But what is the dollar amount?
The dollar amount? Well, I don't have that information in front of me.
I think it's something like 40-some-odd million over the three-day period, and I think it obviously did more over the five-day.
Yeah, it was smart to release it on Wednesday or midnight on Tuesday or whatever. But, you know, because you're competing against Pixar with Ratatouille.
Right.
Yeah,
and that's another really good film, although they're already that's not up to par with the gross of Cars last year, but I actually think it's a far superior movie than
Cars.
Yeah,
the reviews are way better.
Yeah, but
it seems like a harder sell.
It is.
About a rat.
Well, about a rat, but it's not boring. In Cars, I thought, if I was a kid, I would have, like, begged my mom, I would have tugged at her leg, can we leave? Because I was just bored out of my skull watching that, but
Right. Actually, when I went to see Cars, I actually did tug at my mom's leg and ask her to...
Okay, I didn't even know that, Jamie, but thank you very much for sharing that with us. Well, Jamie, what did you think of Live Free or Die Hard?
Well, I think we're all in agreement that the first one is the absolute classic, and the second one is the most disappointing of the bunch. For me, I think that the first one is the best film, but I enjoy watching part three. I can watch part three every couple of months. If it's on TV, I get engrossed in it. I keep kind of revisiting number three, and that's something I don't do with the first one. But it's kind of parallel to my thoughts on, you know, David Lynch's best movie is Blue Velvet, but I enjoy watching Wild at Heart more. That's how I feel about Die Hard and Die Hard 3.
Okay.
But Die Hard 4, I thought it was almost as good as part three, particularly in the second half. I thought that he started to become more like John McClane halfway through when he had that fight with the Asian, with Maggie Q.
Maggie Q, yes.
Yeah, and he has that great line, enough of this kung fu shit, and then he starts to be, you know, that's classic McClane.
That is classic McClane. Okay. So do you consider the second one a disappointment?
Yeah, I do.
Really? I consider none of them disappointments. I think the second one, at the time it was released, was considered a very violent film, and it was a summer of high body counts and high budgets.
Right.
And that has one of the series' greatest lines in it. When John Amos, he goes to John Amos, you know, I thought you, you know, I really like you. I thought you were an asshole. He goes, no, I'm just your kind of asshole. And it's the one, I guess you could say it's similar to this one in the sense that the William Sadler villain and the Timothy Oliphant villain, while he's not a menacing like Jeremy Irons or his brother Alan Rickman.
Hans Gruber.
Yeah, Hans Gruber, yeah. I mean, Jeremy Irons is great, you know, when Bruce Willis tells him in the third one, you know, your brother was a real asshole, and you think he's going to slap him. So he goes, yeah, you're right, he was.
Right. Well, that's a big problem I have with this movie, too, Die Hard 4.
Okay.
I thought that the villain's plan, I thought that his whole motives were great, and they were probably more embedded in real world than all of the other villains.
That's very true.
But I thought he had no color whatsoever. And I like Timothy Oliphant in, like, The Girl Next Door and all the other stuff that he's done because he has this sense of mischief about him. He's like a young Jack Nicholson almost, you know.
Yeah.
But he has no color whatsoever. The direction of the script doesn't allow him any of that. I thought it would have been a lot more interesting if he would have played some kind of twisted enjoyment of seeing that his plan is working, and he's showing the American people what he wants to show them. You know?
No, that's a good point. He's like, you know, I mean, Timothy, the character, I guess, Thomas Gabriel is the character's name, is, I guess, the closest thing we're going to ever come to seeing the Richard Clark, the real-life character Richard Clark brought.
That's not true, because Sean Penn is actually playing Richard Clark in an upcoming movie.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Richard Clark should sue. All these people are playing him. Not that I think Sean Penn will do an excellent job in that film, by the way, based on his books, which if you have not read Against All Enemies, it is worth your time, and I seriously mean that. it is certainly worth your time. But yeah, he's playing this kind of like Richard Clark-like character. And no, compared to Jeremy Irons and even William Sadler and especially Alan Rickman, he is not the most menacing villain. It's his plan, though, is of all four movies, is the most realistic of all of them. It's actually very frightening to watch this unfold, because we know it's something, especially in the last 5 years, it is something that could happen and no one would be able to do anything about.
And the essential draw of the Die Hard movies is there. I mean, it's there in spades, which is John McClane is an everyman, and he's facing villains that are far more sophisticated than he is. That's what makes every single Die Hard work.
Oh, I agree. And in this one, he has almost a Rip Van Winkle quality, because it's such a modern, the digital age. He is this analog character thrown into a digital age, and he's not really, you know, up on things like the Justin Long character, who he's sent to protect to bring in, but he does things his own way. As David Anson said in his review of the second Die Hard, he's a blue-collar James Bond, and that's exactly what he is, and that's his appeal.
And I don't know necessarily, I don't completely agree with casting Justin Long in it either. I think he was fine. But it seems like, you know, we're doing something on computers, we want to attract the younger viewers, let's get the guy that plays the computer on the commercials. It seems very easy, and he's fine, did you notice how many zip caps face? I feel awful just saying that, but when your face is magnified 60 times on screen, shouldn't that make a difference?
It should, and it's and I can't wait, you know, he's probably dreading when that's released on HD DVD.
Well, you can pop them on HD DVD.
Well, really? Okay, I'm going to try that when I get off the show tonight. But
it's a little game you can play, yeah.
It's kind of smart on their part, though, because they really went for the young audience. Like, they made it PG-13, they got a modern director, like, you know, Len Wiseman, and, you know, they got a young guy who's popular with young people, so it was probably a pretty smart move.
Oh, it's a very smart move, and for those people who are worried about the cursing and all that, there is an R-rated version that will come out on DVD.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So don't worry about that. And actually, that should not keep anyone away from this film. I will say this right now. This is the most fun I've had with these summer blockbusters this year, and last year, I may add, as well. You're not going to find a better piece of popcorn entertainment than this. Now, I say this, and of course, Transformers is this week, but as of right now, you're really not going to have this kind of fun.
It is really refreshing to have an old-school action movie not bogged down by special effects. You know, obviously, they use special effects in this movie to create some of the stunts and that kind of thing, but by and large, just an old-school kick-ass, you know, blow shit up, have Bruce Willis smart off to the villains kind of movie. That's where you get your John McClane fix from, and it's all there. I thought it was very good, especially the second half.
Yes, and I also like the scene in the tunnel, I guess, is where it really comes together, because he starts cursing to himself. He starts saying, oh, God, simple routine mission going astray, you know, that classic McClane soliloquy where he's, like, giving himself a hard time. How can the same thing happen to the same guy twice? And
yeah, I think that's a really exceptional sequence.
That is. On every level, it is. I just had a ball with this film.
Yeah, and you know, I think that what else has that director done? Underworld.
The two Underworld movies, I believe.
Yeah, I think he's probably going to be one of the new go-to guys for the big budget action movies. You know, because his work is really impressive, and I was impressed too because I could see everything that was happening. A lot of these action directors, they're cutting so quickly and their cameras jiggling all over the place, you can't get a handle on what's going on, you know?
Right.
I thought that this was good, cleanly directed action.
No, I agree. It was very well done. I was very impressed. I'm sure John McTiernan is probably kicking himself for not taking this.
Yeah, yeah.
Rumor or something that Michael Bay wanted to do this at one time, but...
Oh, thank God he didn't.
Oh, my God.
Well, it would have been a lot of car chases.
Hopefully they learned their lesson with Rennie Harlan.
Well, let me ask you this. Was the Rennie Harlan one considered that bad a film? Yes.
I don't think it was. I mean, I think the movie was popular. Obviously, they made a third movie. You know, I mean, the movie made money. But I don't even dislike it. I just think maybe the same as Jamie. It's the movie that has it has not aged as well as certainly the first movie and the third movie also. The second movie, it kind of has that cheesiness that the first and the third movie. First and the third movies, while they're over the top and they're big blow 'em up kind of movies, they also seem very believable. It also seems very possible. The second one's a little bit preposterous.
Okay.
Entertaining, but preposterous. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that.
No. I was just curious because it's been so long. I was just curious. I mean, I didn't know whether it was something that in the summer of 1990 because you had Total Recall, you had Days of Thunder, and the big thing at the time actually is that each of these movies cost $60 million to make, which at that time was an enormous amount of money.
Right.
And that was the big thing that summer. A lot of people were saying, you know, this is insane to spend this kind of money. And then just a couple months later, the Washington Post broke a story that James Cameron was spending $100 million to make Terminator 2, which, of course, we laugh at now. These numbers are trivial.
Yeah.
But
nothing.
Yeah. Well, I think what the most fascinating thing about Die Hard, as far as American action films go, I think in the 80s, Die Hard is the one to go to, is the one to beat, simply because it's a film that basically became used as a high-concept pitch. It's, you know, Die Hard on a bus like Speed or Die Hard on a plane like Air Force One. The movie set the stage for the future of action films up until the end of the 90s.
And it stands up as one of the best-executed, smartest, examples of those one-line pitch action movies. It started a lot of trends. I think it could have even started Bruce Willis, the transition between TV actor and movie actor.
Oh, it absolutely did. He'd only made one movie. He'd only made Blind Date, which was a good movie and a popular movie, but nobody thought he was an action star at the time. This was Moonlighting.
Yeah, I mean, you have Moonlighting, you have Blind Date, and then after Die Hard, you have the one with James Gardner, Sunset, and then you have the talking baby movie, Look Who's Talking, but it's really the Die Hard movie. Like, I remember when Die Hard came out, I was like, the day it opened, I was like, the guy from Moonlighting is in an action film?
Right.
It was like, what's up with that?
And he says they took it to everyone, like literally everyone at the time. He was the last choice. And, look now, he's still at his age, what is he, 50? He's one of the biggest action stars in the world consistently.
Oh, he hasn't lost a beat in this new movie. I mean, he is an action star.
He is the special effect. He is the star. He is the driving force of the film. I went to go see it probably with his biggest fan, my older brother Michael, and I've gone with other Bruce Willis vehicles in the years where Bruce, you know, hasn't been that great, Tears of the Sun or Heart's War or Hostage, and I thought there'd be blood in the aisles because my brother was really pissed with these films. But this one is just really Bruce at the top of his game, the action genre, and he really just comes through, I think.
I think one of the things that's so appealing about Bruce Willis is you can take Brad Pitt or Tobey Maguire or, you know, any one of these guys, Matt Damon, and pump them up for 6 months, make them pump iron, and put them in an action movie. And it might be a good action movie, and you might enjoy it. You know? But Bruce Willis, no matter what, you always get the impression that he truly could kick the living shit out of you in any situation. Unlike, you know, some of those other guys. Even when they're pumped up, it's like, hey, he looks good, and, you know, he's a good superhero, but, it doesn't seem intimidating.
Bruce Willis can take my parking spot.
Bruce Willis, what I like about the movie, too, the whole Die Hard series, is that he gets the living hell beaten out of him every single one. He is just a bloody mess, and he seems to revel in that, you know?
Right.
And I think it's the worst in part three. I think that he's so, like, crippled and bloodied by the end of that. It's just unbelievable. But I think that, going back to part two, I think that everyone is pretty much in agreement that that's the weakest in the series. I think even Bruce Willis said that about Die Hard 2 as well. He was unhappy with it. And I think it's just, I think Rennie Harlan, there's something about him that he wants to be up to the level of one of our great action directors, but there's something undeniably kind of trashy or like lower class about his movies, how they come out.
Is that because he released The Adventures of Ford Fairlane a month later?
No, I mean, I enjoy some of his stuff. I enjoyed I enjoyed Long Kiss Goodnight. I don't know if I enjoyed it more for the screenplay than I did for the direction.
Right, right.
But he's,
I actually enjoy Ford Fairlane. I don't think that's a terrible
movie. No, I just said, because I know at the time that was the height of Dice's popularity. The movie wasn't very popular. I enjoyed the movie, too. It's a great, you know, it was a good vehicle for him, so.
I think he's a
I know what you're talking about, Jamie. Rennie Harlan's movies seem like they were funded by, like, a flea market or something. like he got the money from a chain of flea markets to go make Driven or Cutthroat Island or whatever it is. Like, he worked
the junk, he's a junk food director, yeah.
Yeah, and then he got Deep Blue Sea, and he's made a couple that I haven't even... I think, did he make Mindhunters?
I think he did, actually.
Okay, and that I never got around to seeing that. Came and went, and...
Yeah, I don't think anyone got around to watching that.
Well, I'm sure there were people who probably wanted to see. I'm sure they usually be, hey, it's a new movie in the theater, let's go see. But no, I just had no interest in that one.
He just did that other one that came that was in and out of theaters in like a sneeze.
Oh, The Covenant, the supernatural one. That was awful.
Yeah.
When I saw his name on it, I nearly, you know, I choked.
Yeah.
What about The Exorcist thing? I only saw Paul Schrader's version of The Exorcist.
I saw them both, and the most unfortunate thing about that is because I saw the Rennie Harlan one first, and it was horrible. Of course,
yes, it was.
Because Rennie Harlan made it. But the most unfortunate thing about the whole scenario was then I saw the Paul Schrader one, and it was horrible. So
they're both,
and
neither, it was, you know, you have to ask yourself, was it necessary? And I have to say on both counts, no, it wasn't.
No, it absolutely wasn't. So.
But I was really excited by the prospect of, because this is the something that we talk about, that we fantasize a lot as movie geeks about, two directors directing the same material.
Same
how
actor.
Different, how, yeah, how different will those movies turn out to be?
True.
Yeah, they turned out different. It was like, you know, it was like the difference between liquid shit and a giant turd. Like
something like stubbing your toe and getting hit by an handstand, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and either way, I got to tell you, watching both of them, and I have to honestly say I'm there. I mean, I've heard of going to the bottom of the well, but this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How
what
unfortunate
about,
for Stellan Skarsgård to have that movie twice on his resume.
Yeah, I know.
No matter what. And he's such a good actor.
Yes, he is.
What about Sicko? You saw Sicko this weekend.
Yes, I did. I saw Sicko, and I would like to tell everyone that regardless of your feelings on Michael Moore, regardless, I think this is a film that, you know, if you're interested in documentaries, no, scratch that. If you're interested in healthcare in this country, if you're interested in voting in the next election, I think this is a film you should probably check out. Yes, it is a polemic. Yes, it is a Michael Moore documentary. But it is probably one of his better documentaries. Not to say that the ones before this are bad. It is just to say that he has taken some of the criticisms and he has taken himself out of the film almost altogether. Yes, he's in it. His voiceover narration is in it. But one of the things he does is he lets the people tell their own stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important to the film. Now, having said this and doing some research today and reading the papers, I would like to, if for people who have seen the film, they should probably read Thomas L. Fisher's article in the Washington Post Outlook section. You can go to WashingtonPost.com. That's just an interesting piece, a different take on it, because he had a problem with the film is that Michael Moore didn't focus on the people who didn't have any health care. Instead of focusing on the middle class, he said that Michael Moore maybe should have focused on the people who didn't, and that's a valid point. Another
he focus on everyone, even people that do have health care that were rejected?
Yes. He focuses especially on that, and the stories. It's a kind of film you're watching, and when they tell you, the people tell their stories about the HMOs and their coverage and what they weren't going to be covered for, you think about, well, wow, how much longer do I have coverage, and God forbid I get sick, you know, are they going to take my coverage away from me?
Yeah.
And it is, in that sense, a very scary film. But I have to say, I think this is Michael Moore's most realized, most accomplished film. And I think if we remember, a couple months ago, we talked about on our Movies That Make a Difference, we talked about Fahrenheit 9/11, and the film basically stands up at this point, is looked upon as a failure because Bush got reelected. And the point of the film, I think, at the time, or at least the way it was sold, was it was the film that was going to defeat Bush. Well, that didn't happen. But I think there's a great positive outcome for this film, and it really relies on everyone going to see it and making sure that the universal health care coverage for all Americans has a chance to become a reality in the next election, and not just voting for whoever this candidate is, but making sure that whoever wins, that they follow through with that.
Right.
And
he's been on interviews, he's been on talk shows circuit a lot to promote this film, and, you know, he's getting a lot of badgering calls saying, you know, why don't you talk about what's good in America? You seem so un-American in your approach. And he said, you know, we have real problems in this country. Basically, this is what he said. And as an American that loves the country, I want to present this to fellow Americans and say, can you believe this is going on in our country? I want this country to be what we've all dreamed it can be, because it can be. We're a compassionate, thoughtful, giving people. And if people realize the extent of these problems, then there'll be something, hopefully something will be done about it. But I think that he's trying to do, he's trying to not embrace controversy as much with this film, because he feels like he really got burned with Fahrenheit.
I think that's partially true, but I think he does, like I said, by taking himself out of the film, not being always on camera, or even his voice isn't even always doing the talking, I think he manages to stay away from that. But there are some people, even like myself, he focuses on all the healthcare systems overseas, and while he definitely focuses on their pluses, he doesn't bring up any of their negatives. And if you wanted to criticize him for something, that would be the thing to criticize him for. Why not? But I understand what he's trying to do in that process. He wants to at least say, look, at least they're trying to do this. They do this at least over here in England or in France. We don't even do that.
Yeah, and I heard him say that, you know, he's not saying that any healthcare system is perfect, even though I haven't seen the film. I don't know if he speaks about negatives of the other healthcare systems. He's just saying, you know, there are two good things about this healthcare system. Why don't we steal those? Why don't we use those for our
exactly.
Country? Yeah, but he, at the same time, he's critical of Hillary Clinton, who's the
yes.
last high-profile politician that tried to do something substantial for healthcare.
And this is, if I have a real beef with the film, not that I think it's right that he, remember, he always said if John Kerry was elected, he would go after John Kerry if he did anything, you know, that wasn't kosher, if he did anything that was wrong. Well, he proves that he would do that with going after Hillary and the money that she got from the health insurance companies. And I think that's a very important point. Harvey Weinstein begged him to cut the scene out. He wouldn't do it. I have to give him points for that.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, though. I was kind of, and I guess, you know, there's only so much time. He may have shot the footage. There were a lot of people that Hillary Clinton employed, and I guess because I live inside the Beltway, you know, to get this health care plan, she had some not unsavory people like Ira Magazine are working on this whole health care initiative, and he doesn't mention those, but I understand why you can't. You don't have that kind of time to really go. He's just trying to get a point across about at least she tried to do something, and when she was shot down, like any other politician, and I have to say, I think a lot of the candidates who are running have been paid off handsomely by the HMOs and health insurance companies.
It's major business.
It is major business.
I'm no lover of Hillary Clinton. I'm no lover of necessarily any of the candidates yet, because I don't know very much about them yet. But yeah, I just thought that was an interesting point to bring up, because she was in the spotlight more than anyone else, I think, pushing this kind of more socialized medicine like Michael Moore advocates.
Yes, no, that's absolutely. Okay, we have a caller on the line from a 402 area code. I'm going to patch them through. Hello, you're on Movie Geeks United.
Hey, Jerry, this is Royce.
Oh, Royce, okay, you're calling from a different area code than I have.
Calling from another phone, yeah.
Okay,
sorry about
welcome
that.
To the show. We are delighted to have you.
Okay, thanks. I'm delighted to be here. Sorry about the confusion.
No, that's quite all right.
So, Dr. Royce Clemens, this is an honor, because we read your stuff all the time, and You're an expert on movies. You're all over the web. So thanks so much for being on our show. We appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. I'm not stepping on the George Ratliff interview, am I?
No. That's something we already did. That's going to be on at we'll put that. That's going to be the end of the show at 9:00. So not at all, my friend. You are on time. A little bit ahead of time, but on time.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry.
So let's talk director's cuts. Our topic of the week.
Okay.
The main thing that I'd like to discuss with director's cuts are, first of all, if they're necessary, but secondly, you know, do they benefit the experience of the film, or are they just playing ego at work? What do you think about that, Royce?
Well, see, to me, you know, sometimes a movie is, I mean, let's face it, for commerce sake, for, you know, to set corporate minds at ease, some movies are taken away from their directors. It's a fact. But when we're getting more and more into the DVD age, it's not like it was in, like, the 80s or the 70s where they had to re-release them in theaters the hard way. But when we're getting into the DVD age, yes, it is more about money. You know, shots are made in movies just to be put on the DVD. And, yeah, it is getting, you know, it is catering to greed and ego more and more. But one thing I can't fathom or understand is that when they are released on DVD, sometimes they don't really give you a choice as to which movie you want to watch. Yeah. Have you noticed this with a few DVDs?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, like they will give you, you know, they will throw at you the unrated extended cut. Like I bought the 40-Year-Old Virgin a year ago.
Right.
Yeah, and it's basically 17 minutes of filler crammed into the two-hour movie that I liked in the theater. I mean, the damn thing was long enough as it was. Have you noticed this?
No, I have noticed this.
Did you buy the 40-Year-Old Virgin?
Yes, I did, and I noticed this when we watched it again. I don't so much... I can understand with that because they're trying to get to the, you know, the young kids, the raunchier stuff, I guess, you know,
yeah.
They're trying... but no, I see where you're coming from. There was nothing wrong with the version we saw in the theater. Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, and I used to buy lots of Laserdiscs in the 90s, and I was kind of, I just started buying Laserdiscs. I had like a collection of several hundred of them, and then DVD came out, and I was like, screw DVD. DVD's not going to go anywhere, you know. I have my big, huge LP versions of these films. But they used to have that option where you could play it with the deleted scenes or play the extended cut and the theatrical cut. But you don't see that so much anymore with DVD.
No, not at all.
You do sometimes. And actually, one of my favorite director's cuts is like that. It's the James Cameron cut of Aliens. And also, we're talking, there's a difference that we should distinguish between, you know, like an unrated version or just a second, like the ultimate edition of a movie that comes out, and a director's cut.
Right.
Director's cut really is, you know, a good director like James Cameron, for instance, is only going to go back and put that stuff in if he really thinks it adds to the story.
Right.
Aliens, the director's cut of Aliens, I think it's better, and I think it's like 20 minutes of extra footage, which James Cameron refers to as 20 miles of bad road. That not bad in the sense that it's bad footage, but bad as in, you know, the movie is just filled with doom and gloom, and it's just more of the same. So
at the same time, I don't think a director necessarily. I think in the cutting room, if you have Final Cut, which certainly Cameron does, certainly Coppola does, certainly a lot of these others, Oliver Stone, perhaps on Alexander, but generally I think Oliver Stone has too. I think that you hate to see things go. And you have to cut them in the editing room.
Oh yeah.
This is kind of an effort to get their babies back, you know, in the movie,
right.
And it doesn't necessarily serve the film.
I don't think it serves the film a lot of times. I actually think the only, and I want to get, because I know Royce has one film he wants to talk about in particular, but I think sometimes it is the version that we do see in the theater is the best version. And I know I'm going to get a lot of disagreement here. I have no problem with the 1982 version of Blade Runner that I saw on opening night.
Right.
With the narration.
I love the voiceover narration. It's
right.
Beautiful. And I don't, and don't get me wrong, I have the director's cut. I like it, but I don't jump on these bandwagons. Oh, when the critics reviewed it, and I think it was 92, oh, the voiceover narration was retarded and all. I'm like, what are you people smoking?
I miss the narration too, Jerry, and I agree with you. And in my opinion, even watching it without the narration, I don't get the impression that he's a replicant. It doesn't make that much of a difference to me. I just miss the narration.
Yeah, exactly. It was.
I got to agree with you.
Yeah.
And it became a classic with the narration. So obviously enough people appreciated the movie with the narration that it didn't hurt its status at all.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I have a question about Blade Runner. It came out... Well, the AFI, the new 10th anniversary special edition with, you know, whipped cream on top.
Yes.
Right.
100 greatest movies of all time.
We got Morgan Freeman to host this time.
Yeah. Because when you need somber, you know, introduction and narration, you get Morgan Freeman. Cause Eddie,
right.
Eddie Deason ain't going to cut it. But,
Blade Runner was awesome.
I just got this image of Eddie Deason as Red in Shawshank, and I just can't get it out. But anyway, Blade Runner came in 97th.
Right.
Now, I did some research, and there are seven cuts of Blade Runner floating around out there. There's the original.
Including the new one that's coming out this year?
Yeah, including that one. Including Yeah, there's the original, two work prints that are floating around, the TV version, the TV version, and the 92 Ridley Scott cut, and another one I'm forgetting about. But yeah, there are seven versions of Blade Runner, and what I want to know is which one of those versions of Blade Runner came in 97th?
That's a very good question.
Yeah, I think, you know, people out there are floating around with completely different, you know, reminiscences about one movie.
Right.
Because is there a point where you have to give up the ghost, do you think? To say, you know, oh, we're done. We don't need to tinker anymore.
I wish that was true, but I look at someone, and I'm going to mention two directors who I do like, but I am upset with the way they have tinkered with their classics, George Lucas being one of them.
Oh, yeah.
And Coppola with The Godfather. For a while, a lot of people were criticizing Coppola for keep going back to The Godfather and playing around with, the, you know, not the original trilogy, but when they showed it on NBC television in the chronological order. A lot of people, and you do have to ask yourself, how much longer are you going to try to milk this?
Yeah.
Right.
And with Lucas, it's rather disturbing because I've never seen someone so eager to destroy their. I'm not talking about the prequels. I'm talking about the original trilogy where he had to felt the need to put Hayden Christensen in Return of the Jedi at the end.
Yeah.
Right.
And you just have to ask yourself, when is enough enough?
Yeah. Especially
this is George Lucas we're talking about here. It's never going to be enough.
No, I mean he's going to have to come out
vision.
And put. All the Jedi Knights in Return of the Jedi who passed away in the Revenge of the Sith are going to be in that last scene in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Well, with the Godfather films, once you put it in chronological order, you take a big chunk of what makes those films art, especially that second film.
Especially the second film.
The drama of that second film is the parallel between Pacino and De Niro and his father.
Yeah,
and you take that out and you remove what made that movie so spectacular.
I agree 100%, Jamie, with that. I couldn't agree more.
So what about Apocalypse Now? What about his reworking of that?
The Boobs and French People version.
Yes,
I gotta tell you, it's good, but I like the original better because the Apocalypse Now Redux basically adds a whole bunch of filler and makes it more realistic. And personally, for me, the appeal of the original cut of Apocalypse Now, the 2-hour and 19-minute one that we all know and love, is that it's so damned hallucinatory.
Absolutely.
It's the product of Willard's diseased mind. And then you watch, you know, the documentary made about the making of Apocalypse Now, Hearts of Darkness.
Yes, a wonderful film.
Yeah, and you can see that Coppola was going just as crazy as Willard while he was making the movie. And that adds another layer of...
Yes, it does.
Of enjoyment.
Plantation scene,
if only for me.
The French plantation scene is actually one of the most eerie kind of dreamlike scenes in the movie, one of the major segments that he added. It's like these people are living in a time warp.
Right, very haunting.
Yes.
Chris, you actually have a very different view of the Apocalypse Now Redux.
Well, I don't know which particular view you're talking about. I am a person that thinks that it's better. For me, Apocalypse Now is the greatest war film ever made. It's the best, and guys like war films, and I'm a guy that likes war films, and it's the best. Apocalypse Now is like a blowjob. You put 30 more minutes, an hour more into it, hey, great.
Well, you would love the 5-hour. There's a 5-hour version somewhere in Germany.
I would totally watch it. I would sit and watch it. And I think it works better, too, because, like we were saying, it makes it more real. It's just more hell.
Yeah.
The whole movie is hell. He's going through hell. It's just more, you know, like the colony, the French colony, it's just more hell. They're showing their little hell that he's getting involved in.
Right.
And with the prostitute or the Playboy bunnies, I love that scene, actually. I think I like that scene better than the French plantation, not just because of the tits, but it's just these guys are still not able to enjoy themselves. They're still in hell. Like, it's still, you're with a Playboy bunny, it should be fantastic, but it really isn't for any of them exactly. And it's just, I love it. I think it's fantastic.
Okay, I think I have to cut in here and make a confession. And I'm sure the people downstairs at my house will understand this. This is probably one of my favorite films ever made, with the exception maybe of Lawrence of Arabia. But I have to say, as much, and I enjoyed watching it again in the theater on the Redux version, I do like. And I think the reason the French Plantation scene works is because it's a dream-like sequence. I mean, you could cut it out. It's very easy to cut out because it's almost like a dream. And, because when we're done with that sequence, we get to, you know, crazy Dennis Hopper as the photojournalist and his, you know, did you know if is the middle word in life? But this film, I agree with Royce here. There was nothing wrong with it with when it came out. It's perfect. I don't even know, Chris, I would call it a war film. I think it's so much more than that.
You're right.
No, but you're right to say that. I mean, you're absolutely right to say that. I just think it works on so many different levels.
It absolutely does. I agree with you 100%. But it's
awesome. I'm going to say at this point that I think that Apocalypse Now is the only film I've ever seen that almost successfully replicates seeing life literally, you know, almost literally, through another person's eyes.
That's a good point. Through Willard's eyes, you mean, right?
Yeah, Willard's eyes.
Yeah.
The dementia that's taking place, the fatigue, all is filtering through what he sees.
Which is essentially Coppola's eyes too,
because
I think that to truly appreciate Apocalypse Now, I think that watching that documentary Hearts of Darkness is essential, because never before has the journey a director has taken so embedded itself in the actual film. You are seeing life unfolding before your very eyes. That whole experience is in that film, and all this kind of outlandish kind of surreal stuff. I can imagine that that's really how that war was. There was lots of drugs. I mean, the fact that you're in a jungle overseas fighting a war, lots of bloodshed, and all of a sudden Playboy bunnies are falling from the sky, which really happened. I mean, that is surreal.
That is absolutely. Gentlemen, we have a caller on the line from the 469 area code. I'm going to patch them through. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, you guys, this is Shelly in Dallas.
Oh, welcome, movie fan.
This movie fan, hey. So loving your topic. As far as Redux, I have to disagree. I really feel like it positively killed the pacing of the film. The scene with the bunnies, although it added some levity, it totally takes away from the fact that they're like in a hurry to get there, yet they're going to stop and trade the gasoline for sex. Then the whole scene at the end where Willard has sex with a French woman.
Yeah.
It's completely like it's scored by a different person. It's like a synthesizer, bad 80s porno.
That's very good, Shelly.
It just really took away from what was just a quintessential war movie in my mind.
Okay. Well, going on that, it's very interesting you bring that up, because Colonel Walter E. Kurtz is, I think, probably the most important third act character since Harry Lime in The Third Man.
Yeah.
You know, he hunts. I mean, Kurtz hunts the whole movie. We're waiting to meet him.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we're waiting to meet him, obviously, in Coppola's mind also, before he showed up to the set 50 pounds overweight. We're waiting to meet him, but it's still, he hunts the whole movie. So I think, I agree with Shelley that we do, you know, it takes forever, you know, with that version, and a five-hour version, it will take longer to get there. But we are Kurtz. We just can't wait to meet him. We've heard so much about him through Willard's wonderful voiceover narration.
He's the devil. I mean, he's going to meet the devil.
Yes.
Yeah, and the possible future version of himself.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I have no problem with the end of the movie, and where so many people say, oh, it's great, and then it falls apart at the end. How else would you end it? It's all building up towards that.
Yeah, I have no problem. I've never had a problem with the ending.
Yeah, but
no,
you've
me
heard
either.
That argument before, haven't you?
I've heard it. I've heard different versions, and I'm not going to go into this now because we don't have 20 hours. I could give you the Dr. Dennis version of the ending. It should have ended where he shoots everyone on the boat. It was a very short movie.
Is Shelley still on the line?
Yeah, Shelley, are you still with us?
I'm still on the line.
Oh, thank you for calling in, Shelley.
Yes, thank you.
It's really nice to hear a female voice on the show for once.
Yes.
Rarely if ever.
Thanks for having me on, you guys.
All right, thank you very much. Have a happy 4th of July, Shelley.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Before we get into quick picks, flick picks, I wanted to talk about Oliver Stone's Alexander, which is going on like it's a third cut or something. Was that a lost cause from the beginning? Or, you know, is he just not wanting to accept the fact that his movie just didn't quite make it?
Well, his cut was shorter, wasn't it?
I don't know.
His first director's cut was shorter.
No, that doesn't always
mean that it's just these interchange scenes taking a different take, you know, that could make it a couple minutes shorter. But it was actually, you know, usually a director's cut. All these other movies we're talking about, they're considerably longer.
Well, look, this is his one major critical and audience failure. I mean, across the board. And I think this is the only one that he went back with JFK. But I think, yeah, he did that with JFK too, which is sacrilege to me because JFK is one of my all-time favorite movies. And all the stuff that he adds in, it doesn't add anything to the film necessarily as a film. But I think no one's really ever asked Oliver Stone, did you not like the first cut? You know, because he seems so unhappy with it. He keeps going back and tinkering. I just want to know if he wasn't happy with what he put out. You know?
Yeah, it's a movie that, you know, you can talk about any director, and they've got movies that are perceived as, you know, failures, like, you know, Scorsese with New York, New York or something like that, or Coppola with The Cotton Club. Those movies are perceived as failures, but you can still find people to defend them. And there's not a lot of people out there that are willing to defend Alexander. Maybe
no,
like,
I'm not willing to defend it.
Yeah, I mean, even for a big A-class director, it's, like you're saying, a failure across the board.
Yeah, and I think he senses that, and I think that's why he's going back more than just, you know, that he personally thinks that his first cut was crap.
Right. Well, guess what? He's right.
Are you there, Royce?
Yeah. I'm
okay, because I had some connection problems, so I'm sorry if you got cut off there. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, it's all right.
Okay. I have to say something about Alexander. I just wasn't crazy about the first cut, and I can't – it's just – you don't have anything great to work with there, in my mind, and I can't see. You could go back and tinker with it all you want. I'd rather see what Christopher McQuarrie or Baz Luhrmann was going to do with Alexander the Great, or
yeah.
I'd just rather go back and watch the Richard Burton one.
I think it might be a subject that's just too freaking big for anybody.
I don't know. I think Jerry's right. I think the Richard Burton film actually conquers it, so to speak, better than the Oliver Stone, as amazing as that is. I think the Richard Burton version is a pretty good film.
Yeah.
It gives you an
the
impression
opening
of
day of Alexander was my birthday in 2004. Happy birthday to me. I saw that on opening night.
I saw it. Yeah, so did I.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I wanted to get my back looked at the next day, but
yeah.
Actually, speaking of birthdays, Chris's birthday is Tuesday, so let's all wish him happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Chris.
Happy birthday, Chris.
Happy birthday,
buddy.
I want all the listeners out there to flood Chris's MySpace page with happy birthday wishes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll be going to see Transformers for my birthday.
That sounds good to me.
Flick picks. You want to do flick picks?
Yeah, let's do flick picks. Royce, you have the floor.
All righty. I'm doing an article sometime in the near future on my blog. Probably tomorrow, because it's staring at me lonely. Looks like I've been cheating on it with the TV. But anyway, I'm doing a blog on double features. You know how they've apparently aren't around anymore. But I have this unique double feature of two actors playing so far against type, they literally have to be seen to be believed. One is David Mamet's The Spanish Prisoner.
Mm. Good
choice. Steve Martin playing this really icy businessman. This brilliant work. I think probably Steve Martin's last good work that ever graced theaters.
That's I'm with you. I'm with you there.
Yeah.
I like Shop Girl, but yeah, Spanish Prisoner is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other one is Joe Pesci playing a romantic lead in The Public Eye.
That's a great film. We were talking
yeah.
about it the other day.
Yeah. It's the following for that movie is so small, it's not even out on DVD yet. Yeah, that's just a damn shame. But anyway, those are my picks.
Those are good picks.
Those are excellent picks.
The Public Eye is actually, it's on demand on my Bright House cable subscription. It's
really?
Free. It's free. All you got to do is press play. It's thrown in there with other kind of forgettable, actually bad movies.
Okay.
I've rarely heard anyone speak about The Public Eye. So what makes that such a great film? I've never seen it.
The Public Eye came out in 1992. It's directed by Carl Franklin or Howard Franklin?
I think it's Howard Franklin, who did Quick Change with Bill Murray.
Oh, yeah, Howard Franklin, yeah. Set in the 1940s, film noir. Joe Pesci plays this guy called the Great Bernzini. He's a crime scene photographer, kind of like Great Ouija was back in the 1940s. Tried to sell off his crime scene photos as art. But anyway, it was being sold as a film noir. It looks like a film noir, barks like a film noir. But what I was really impressed about was the love story between Pesci and Barbara Hershey.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very underplayed because, you know, they're both going outside of their stations because Pesci, as Bernsey, is, you know, lives in this rat hole apartment, wakes up at like 10 o'clock every night to go out and, you know, take pictures to sell for the morning papers. Hershey, on the other hand, is this, you know, high society girl who hires Pesci to, you know, do some snoop work for him with his camera. And it's so wonderfully underplayed. And yes, I just referred to a Joe Pesci performance as underplayed.
Right.
But yeah, it's just so underplayed because they're both going outside their social stations and they both have, you know, a hell of a lot to lose. And it's just really good writing and really strong acting. And
I need to underplayed how? Underplayed like I don't play enough? Like I should play more? Underplayed
oh my
how?
God. Dude.
not cool.
Not
anyway.
Cool. Hey, we have two callers on the line. I'd like to get we have one from a 202 area code has been holding. I would like to patch that person through.
Okay.
Hello, 202, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, it's Napoleon B.
yes, I have two legends on the show. I have Royce and I have Napoleon B. Napoleon, welcome back. What can we
do
for you?
No, I just wanted to congratulate you guys for convincing me to go see the Die Hard film. I hadn't seen any of them since the first one, and what you guys are saying made me remember that I actually did like that a lot, and I guess if this one has anything in common with that in terms of the feeling you get from it, then maybe I should actually get down to the theater and watch it. I've got kind of a bad taste in my mouth about Bruce Willis otherwise, but maybe this will be worth the watch.
If you like it,
rent the other two, man.
Yeah, I think you'll enjoy yourself, MB.
Very
I really
good.
Do.
Very good.
Good time.
The other thing is I've been reading some pretty awful things about Michael Moore on Slovenian blogs this weekend.
Yeah, I saw that. You were writing about that.
No, but, you know, actually, there's something about that I realized later. That there's something about some of these films lately, like, what's the one, Hostel, I think it is, that as a depiction of some kind of torture, murder.
Oh, MB, you cannot, when Royce is on, mention Eli Roth. The first rule of Brian De Palma Fight Club, when Royce is on Movie Geeks United, we do not talk about Eli Roth.
You're okay. Fucking A-right you don't talk about
Eli Roth. Well, no, you know, it's this depiction of some kind of murder, torture chamber. And I think, well, wait a minute, that's the stuff that actually happens in America, not in Central Europe. But
wow, you are so right there.
But, yeah, it seems like a little point, but there are some of these films, and I know, of course, Borat being a parody, but, in fact, a lot of people didn't actually catch on to the parody and think, yeah, that's what those places are like.
Yeah.
But, it's just one of these things that kind of bugs me, having spent so much time living in that part of the world, and just, I guess, in general, thinking about Europe, and I know, you know, Michael Moore has a lot of good things to say about France and the UK, as if, you know, those are sort of the cool places in Europe, and everything else is just this giant bog, you know, with the
right. Human
pigs and people, you know, carrying coal on their backs. But
right. Anyway,
the thing about these director's cuts or special cuts, I think actually there's a lot of films made today that can benefit from sort of the opposite effect, where you can take, say, 20 to maybe 45 minutes in the case of Pirates of the Caribbean actually out of the movie, then it would
exactly.
be so much better.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That's a good point.
That's a good point.
Thank you so much for calling in, Napoleon. Thanks.
Yes, thank you very much. It is very good to hear you. I'm glad you're back.
Hey, thanks very much, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, and have a good 4th of July, my friend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye.
Can we do Chris's flip pick real quick?
Yes, we can. Yes.
All right, mine is I'm sitting around with my family today. Gandhi's on TV. Somebody mentions Ben Kingsley's got a new movie out, that You Kill Me, the John Dahl movie.
It's a great movie.
Well, then I mention Sexy Beast.
Yes!
No one in the room has seen it, and my heart broke, because this is one of the best movies of the decade so far for me.
Oh, yeah. Dude,
did you hug him? Did you tell him it was going to be okay?
What's that?
Did you hug him? Did you tell him it was going to be okay? Are you going to fix that problem?
No. I said, just like Don Logan and Sexy Beast, I said, no fucking way,
no fucking way. You think that's fine, go to sunny Spain, leave me all alone here, you think that's fine, you fucking cunt?
No, it strikes me, it strikes
me. Look like a fucking idiot, I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're like fat crocodile, fat bastard.
You know, hearing you guys able to quote the movie, like, gives me a little pleasure, because I'm thinking that this is going to be one of those movies, I really do believe, like Big Lebowski, that's going to develop a following more and more in the coming years, because it's brilliant. It's beautiful. It's full of fantastic performances. Well, no, the first time that I really recognized Ray Winstone and...
he plays against type in that movie, too.
I'm sorry?
He plays against type in that movie, too. Ben Kingsley's
exactly.
playing...
Exactly. He's big, lovable gal. Lovable
because he's not... He's a horrible... He's like the Ben Kingsley character in his movies before this.
That's right.
What strikes me about your whole story, Chris, is that you and your family are on vacation, and they're in there watching Gandhi.
It was early this morning. We were flipping through channels, watched a couple minutes of it. That's not how we pass time.
Okay, hey Jamie, let's do your flick pick. I'll sacrifice mine, but let's do yours.
Well, mine is a little bit more of a popular one, I guess. But I was thinking about old school action movies, and then you know we're talking about doing a tribute show next month to some of the character actors who are so good, like Harry Dean Stanton and M. Emmett Walsh, and you know the people that are always in these great movies, great performances, but never get celebrated so much. And I was thinking of another character actor, J.T. Walsh.
One of the best. Yeah.
So many things. So I'm combining him with old school great action movies, and I'm thinking Breakdown.
Good choice.
Movie. Yeah, it's a great, just tightly wound kind of thriller action movie. And it just works so well. And Kurt Russell has made, you know, several throwaway movies in that genre, especially as of late. But Breakdown is a really strong, old school, great movie.
Okay,
Jonathan Mostow.
Yeah, wonderful. That's a very good choice. Okay, well we're going to end this, but we got a call from the 914 area code. I'm going to patch him through. Hello, you're on the air.
Yo, man, yo, what's good? What's good? Great to be here with you, man. Man, what's your name? What be your name?
Who is this?
Yo, man, why? That ain't be funny, man. I just be polite. What's your name, man?
What's up? It's Jerry.
Yo, what's up, Jerry? My name is Tariq, man. What's good? What's good? Yo, I want to focus my attention on this movie. I think Slow Burn, man. You ever seen that movie, man?
Yes, I did.
Yo, Slow Burn be the shit, man. Teach me everything about life, man. Yo, man. Wayne Beach, director of Wayne Beach, man, he'd be awesome, man. Yo, teach me everything about life. That man, the quotes, man, like the pocket you in ain't always the pocket you in, man. I want to talk about that, man. What do you find good about that movie, man?
I liked it a lot, but we are running out of time, my friend, so we are about to close this up, but thank you very much for calling.
Oh, man, you would be racist, man. You'd be an asshole, man. I'm talking you ain't no racist, man. don't laugh, man. I mean, I'm calling up right here.
We'll get a translator for you next time. Next time you call in, we'll have a translator ready.
Oh, shut your fucking ass, nigga. Why don't you talk to me like that? Little inbred fuck.
Right. Yeah, I think that was Will.
Shut your mouth. Don't sit in your basement and talk to your radio show. Fucking racist, nigga.
Will?
Well, okay. All right, well, that was different.
You know, he seems like
I thought his dick was going to be...
real fucking...
I don't know, man. But, hey, guys, we are out of time. We're running, and I would just like to thank Roy so much for calling in. I'd like to thank everyone for calling in tonight, even our last caller.
Yes.
And it was a great show. We are going to end this. Jamie, would you like to just give a little prologue to your interview?
To the last caller?
Not that.
We're going to end the show tonight for our archive listeners, a special interview with the director of Joshua. And Joshua comes out on limited release this coming weekend, next weekend. It's a thriller that stars Sam Rockwell and Vera Farmiga. It's going to be a really fantastic film. But just sit back and enjoy the interview with the film's director, George Ratliff.
Okay, and hey, I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to wish everyone a happy 4th of July. You guys are great.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let me tell you a little bit about the movie first. In director George Ratliff's new psychological thriller, Joshua, the world of an affluent Manhattan family is turned upside down when their increasingly disturbed son begins to act out against his newborn sibling. This intensely performed and gorgeously shot and directed film earned raves at this year's Sundance Film Festival, where it went on to earn a nomination for Best Independent Dramatic Feature and won the award for Excellence in Cinematography. Dwayne Burge of The Hollywood Reporter calls it a brilliant house of horror tale with Hitchcockian flair, and festival audiences have placed it among the ranks of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining and Roman Polanski's Rosemary's Baby. It is my pleasure to welcome to the show one of our most exciting young directors, Mr. George Ratliff. Mr. Ratliff, are you there?
Oh, my God. What an intro. Jesus.
Did I build it up for you enough? It's really an honor to have you on here.
Oh, thank you.
So many of us are so excited about this film because it seems like a smart, intelligent character and performance-driven psychological thriller, and that's very rare these days.
Yeah, I feel like after all these slasher movies, it'd be fun to do something with a little more meat on its bones, not off the bone. But this is the funny thing is that this movie is much more akin to like With a Friend Like Harry or Read My Lips or Cachet or the Beat My Heart Skip, these sort of thrillers that are steeped in naturalism rather than supernatural.
Absolutely. Do you think that, I know you have a history in documentary filmmaking, and this is your second narrative film after Purgatory County?
That's right.
Did you take any tools from your documentary experience that proved useful in making Joshua?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I learned a lot from, especially from Hell House, which was, Hell House is more of a verite-styled film, sort of a fly on the wall. But when you're doing a movie like that, you still, you go into a scene, the scene has a beginning, middle, and end, and there are characters in it that have an arc, and you have to establish them and the geography of the place. And it's really like you're making a movie, but you're doing it, on the spur of the moment. You have to sort of write it and edit it as you're going, as the things are happening. And what that allowed, and then after when you're editing the verite movie, you're sort of agonizing over those shots that you wish you had, or if you wish you knew that was going to happen, you could have, gotten a different angle on that or something like that. And I found that making Joshua was kind of a luxury because I was able to storyboard intensely every shot of the movie and rehearse the actors, in advance and, figure out every aspect of the movie beforehand on the actual place where we'd be shooting it. And that allowed me to really make a very stylized movie, even though we had a very short amount of time to do it.
Right. But I would think, too, from the documentary experience that it would lend kind of the naturalism that you were talking
about. Well, absolutely. Yeah. And that's something that's... the funny thing is that when we made Hell House, it's we very specifically went for that look. And oddly enough, I would sit and watch movies like Husbands and Wives with my DP, like saying, this is what we're going for. This fake documentary that's supposed to look like a 70s documentary is what we're going for.
Right.
Because, it also, that brings something to the viewing. Even, this imposed naturalism, and we achieved that in Joshua 2. But the funny thing about it is that The naturalism of the performance stays there the entire time, but the look of Joshua has a shift.
Right.
And I'm very excited about that and what we achieved with our DP, Benoit Deby.
I very much want to talk about the cinematography, but first of all, in conceiving the project, I know you co-wrote the script with David Gilbert.
That's right.
Did you want to craft a psychological thriller and then the idea came, or what inspired this?
This is all David's fault. He wanted to make an Evil Kid movie, and I really had no interest because I just started having kids myself, and I didn't want to wade into that pool, you know. Because when you start making a movie, you're kind of in the middle of it for a couple of years. And but because I didn't want to make it, I kept sort of thinking of reasons why this movie wouldn't work or be good, and we kept finding great solutions to every problem I presented, and they got to where we just both got so excited we had to write it.
Oh, wow.
But no, you know what? I mean, what interests me most about it is that I think it taps into a primal fear, and that is that, you know, you'll have a kid that is just eat bad, and it's not your fault. It's just he's just a bad kid. And I remember my brother when he first had his first son. I was so excited, and I was talking about like what all this kid could grow up to be, like, you know, a lawyer or a doctor. And he was driving and very solemnly said, "Yeah, but he could grow up to be a serial killer." And I thought, wow, God, yeah, he could, Jesus.
There's always that consideration. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But and I thought it's even scarier, the idea that there's no good reason for him to do it. And I think that people, when you're looking at an evil kid, you need some solution, like it's like he's possessed, or there's a ghost, or there's, you know, aliens, or something like that. Like Village of the Damned was one of my favorite evil kid movie, but I thought the scariest possible thing is that he just is.
Right. But I would think that it would be very easy in terms of the performance to fall into the stereotypical Damien, that kind of thing. I know you got an exceptional child actor, Jacob
Jacob
Cogan?
Cogan, yeah.
Cogan.
The real premise of Josh was that he's a brilliant kid. He's a prodigy. But he and that's a tough thing to cast, mm-hmm. because, you know, he is nine after all. And we knew we found something with Jacob because Jacob is really that smart.
Wow.
and which was, you know, a little disconcerting in its own right. But the problem with Jacob was that he didn't play the piano.
Okay.
And so we were, you know, casting around for stunt double hands for the piano playing. But we thought we'd put Jacob in piano lessons to see if we got anywhere with that. And I actually took him to his piano lesson. It was his Juilliard piano teacher. And I brought this Beethoven sonata with me. And the piano teacher was like, "Oh, there's no way. This is one of the most complicated sonatas out there. And Beethoven's hands were huge. There's no way this boy could play." And I went to Jacob's house 2 weeks later to sort of keep going through the script because we were working on it together. And he sat down at the piano and played the sonata. And I was very frightened.
Mind-blowing, yeah. And I thought it was interesting, too. Isn't the newborn in the film actually Jacob's own sibling?
Well, it's in the opening sequence, kind of what happens is Joshua, his sister, is born, and you see her sort of right during the first examination of mm-hmm. It's part of the title sequence. And, you know, in movies, you notice that newborns are actually these three-month-old babies sort of covered in goo or something. And
right.
They're all fat and huge. And this was an actual newborn. This was Jacob's baby brother, 3 days old, and his mother, you know, let us film him. And it really was a huge gift to the film because, you know, part of the whole fear of the movie is your fear for this baby. And
right.
when you see an actual newborn truly and see how unprotected and helpless this, you know, baby is. It really sort of biologically does something to you as a viewer.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful sequence too. And and Jacob as an actor had that, you know, that added thing of sibling sort of jealousy and rivalry of having a new baby.
So that
it was very real for him as an actor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you have a sensational cast that you've assembled in this movie.
I don't know. I'm so lucky that this cast. Yeah.
Yeah. Really. Sam Rockwell, Vera Farmiga. What do they bring to the table for you?
Well, you know, I was saying that the movie, it was very important for it to work, to be really steeped in a very true realism and a naturalism. And Sam and Vera are kind of rock stars in method acting, and they're really extremely respected within the acting community, especially because they're I think they're both incapable of doing something they just don't totally believe. Every scene they did, we found a way for them to really believe it, and their performances are imbued with so many layers of characterizations that weren't in the script. They brought so much to it. I'd like to say that Sam signed on just because he really loved me, but he liked me and he liked the script. But it was when I sort of dangled the possibility of Vera Farmiga that he really jumped at the chance to do the movie, and the same one for Vera. They just both wanted to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And they both liked the project, but when they both heard of each other, they both jumped together.
Yeah.
And then we managed to get Celia Weston, who's amazing, and Dallas Roberts, who I'm a fan of, and Michael McKean.
Yeah.
It was an amazing cast, and they were all in New York. They're all New Yorkers or in New York at the time, so we had a great rehearsal process too. We had a lot of time to rehearse and spent a lot of time rehearsing. They were all up for rehearsing.
How long was the rehearsal process?
Well, we had several weeks to do it, and it started quite early with Sam and Jacob, because that was pretty important. And they had an amazing, a great first meeting, you know, because kind of the backbone of the movie is the father-son relationship, you know, that turns into kind of a chess match.
Right. You know, I know too with the strength of the performances. When you're building suspense, how important is it? Is it the most important thing to invest in your characters to make that believable and effective, more so than the pyrotechnics or any of the bells and whistles?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the plot comes from character, and character comes from plot, and the characters really, and there's so much you can have in a script, but they put so much, they imbue it with so much more in the performance. A lot of the movie, you empathize and go along the line with Sam Rockwell's character, Brad, and one of the advantages of Sam is that I think it's impossible not to like Sam. You're on this ride with Sam the entire movie, and you go down the entire path with him, and it's a hard, intense, frightening path that we take in the movie.
Yeah. And I would think that, I've always wondered about this, when you're producing a film that is that intense, what kind of tone do you try to keep on the set?
You know, it was. I have to say, it was a fun set. It was a fun movie. And the thing that no one expects, and that the producers, I kept telling the producers that this movie is actually going to be funny. And they never believed it.
Very dark comic, yeah.
And it's very funny. And it was... And it's funny in a interesting way, and it sort of plays in the relationship between anxiety and laughter, which I think is very interesting. And they feed on each other. The set was great. Everyone really got along. It was kind of a charmed experience. And I hate to sound stupid, but I had a great time, and I don't regret anything in this movie. And
yeah.
I'd heard so many horror stories, but it went really well. And the producers wanted to make the same movie I did, and it was just lucky.
I know most people think that you know, if you're making a film that intense and kind of tightly wound, that the set has to be a nightmare. But actually, I've heard from a lot of directors that you know, it's important to keep a kind of a levity on the set to kind of offset that.
Yeah, well, you know, everyone works differently, but I we had a really nice time.
Yeah, stylistically, we were talking about the cinematography a little bit ago. What were you trying to achieve?
Well, I think I threw out some movies that I really liked and were a big influence on this. Like, and they were mostly French or European films, and there's a coldness to them that I think is amazing. But what we did on Joshua is that the movie sort of degrades. As the look of the film degrades, sort of as Sam's, as Brad's character sort of unravels. And the movie begins, it's sort of cool in tone, but it's long lenses so people look nice, and it's kind of a smooth handheld where it's kind of a living frame. But as the movie progresses and Joshua takes over, the angle gets lower and lower, and the lenses get wider and wider, and so it gets, and the moves become no more handheld, but more precise or locked down. And so a feeling sort of takes over the look of the movie. But also, we employ a bleach bypass that's progressive. And
oh, really?
What a bleach bypass is, basically you skip one of the baths and the fixers of the actual film print.
Mm-hmm.
And what that creates is a less saturated and more contrasty look, a starker look.
Absolutely.
And so Reel 1, we did nothing to. Reels 2, 3, and 4, we did a half of a skip bleach bypass, so it's a bit less saturated, a bit more contrasty. And Reels 5 and 6, we did a full skip. So if you looked at the beginning and end of the movie, they look like totally different films, but as you're watching it, it's such a subtle thing that comes upon the movie, you don't notice that it's happening.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And so the look of the film goes through the same sort of... it breaks down the same way that Brad's character does.
Oh, goodness, that's great.
No, I'm very excited, and it opens up July 6th here in New York and in L.A.
And then it will have a rollout.
And then, it platforms out from there.
Before I let you go, I just have one more question. I can't let you go without hearing about your Sundance experience. I know.
Well, you know, I'd never been to Sundance, and it was... I didn't know what to expect, and it kind of—I had—I had to say—I had a fantastic time. I was very nervous, and it was very nerve-wracking. And but we, you know, we sold our movie to Fox Searchlight on the second day we were there,
wow.
And it was—and that was kind of my big hope. It was that company, and so I from that point on, I had nothing but fun.
Wow.
It was very relaxing. I got to see a lot of movies, and it was great. It was great.
Well, fantastic. We're all looking very forward to this film. July 6th it comes out.
That's right.
In limited release. Thank you so much for
joining us. Thank you for having me.
It's been great having you. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
George Ratliff, the director of the upcoming film Joshua.